I want to be an intercessor, study number 3, in which Paul shares how to pray for a recent church plant. And our text, Colossians 1, verses 9 to 11. For this reason, since the day we heard about you, we have not stopped praying for you. Continually we ask God to fill you with the knowledge of his will through all the wisdom and understanding that the Spirit gives, so that you may live a life worthy of the Lord and please him in every way, bearing fruit in every good work, growing in the knowledge of God, being strengthened with all power according to his glorious might, so that you may have great endurance and patience, and giving joyful thanks to the Father, who has qualified you to share in the inheritance of his holy people in the kingdom of light, for he has rescued us from the dominion of darkness and brought us into the kingdom of the Son he loves, in whom we have redemption, the forgiveness of sins. One thing the empire could never do was to stop Paul praying. Here he is in chains, chapter 4, verse 18, apparently right out of the battle. But of course it's not so. And what an encouragement that is for church pastors who are in prison today. Paul is praying for the little churches of the Lycus Valley, recent plants in Colossae and Laodicea. What's particularly helpful for us is that it is an informed prayer, for Paul had recently received news from Epaphras, who was incidentally a prayer warrior himself, chapter 4, verse 12. This report had brought wonderfully encouraging news of growth in grace among the believers. But there was also not such good news. Certain troublemakers, professing believers, had been unsettling the recent converts. A serious consequence of this had been to knock the Christian assurance of these young church members. And it is this matter that Paul addresses in a very thoughtful prayer. Since assurance of our right standing with God is a privilege all Christian people can enjoy, the Colossian prayer has value for us as well as for the Colossians. It's as powerful and relevant today as it was all those years ago. Bible students will know that in Colossians chapter 2, verses 8 to 23, we have a description of these troublemakers and their teaching. I don't plan to deal with these verses here in this study. They present what has variously been called the Colossian heresy, the Colossian error, or the Colossian mistake. The late Professor Charlie Merle preferred the term mistake. And in his edition of Colossians in the Cambridge Greek Testament series, Cambridge University Press, 1955, he writes that the mistake current at Colossae was to suppose that completeness, that is his word, could not be found in Christ alone, but must be sought through additional rites and beliefs. This mistake, error or heresy, take your pick, continues to this day. This then is all the general context we need in order to appreciate Paul's wisdom. Actually, most readers of Colossians will not even have this information. The references to new moon celebrations, angel worship, and harsh treatment of the body will mean little or nothing to them. So we, like them, will simply take the words here as they stand and as a rich expression of Christian intercession. No reading between the lines is necessary. But when we have carefully considered each part of the Colossian prayer, we shall, I think, have a pretty shrewd idea what is the purpose and point of the whole letter. Here then is a suggested outline of Paul's prayer. 1. Paul does not doubt the convert's spirit-given understanding. Verse 6. But he does pray that they may continue to grow in their knowledge and understanding of God, verses 9 to 11. Second, Paul does not doubt the convert's experience of the power of God, verses 3 to 8. But he does pray that they may increasingly know the strength of Christ in order to keep going as believers against all distractions and hostility. Verse 11. 3. Paul does not doubt the convert's standing before God as redeemed and forgiven people. But he does pray for an even more joyful and thankful realization of their Christian assurance. Verses 12 and 13. I'll repeat these. Paul does not doubt the Colossians' spiritual understanding, powerful conversion, or proper standing before God. What he does pray for is growing knowledge, increasing strength, and a full assurance of their privileged position as God's holy people. It's a prayer for Christian consistency, Christian constancy, and a right Christian confidence. So let's look at prayer one again, and I'm going to read it, if I may, once more. We continually ask God to fill you with the knowledge of his will through all the wisdom and understanding that the Spirit gives, so that you may live a life worthy of the Lord and please him in every way, bearing fruit in every good work, growing in the knowledge of God. It is possible that the troublemakers offered a special gnosis, a kind of Gnostic understanding of the mysteries of God, such was very common in the first and second century. Whether that's so or not, there's no need to bother us very much at the moment. Paul's understanding of knowledge and spiritual understanding was quite different. The greater our spiritual understanding and the more mature our knowledge, the better equipped he saw us to be to live a life worthy of Jesus, pleasing him in our ways and bearing fruit in every good work. Even more telling, it will be as a result of this consistent Christian living day by day that we shall be able to grow in our knowledge of God. Here we have a concept of knowledge that is not mere top story intellectualism. It is, in Paul's language later, to have the full riches of complete understanding. It's the wisdom that Christ alone imparts. It's the necessary equipment if we are to remain firm and stable in the complexities of daily living. It's to leave childish Christianity for spiritual maturity. It is to be reliable men and women in our choices and in our refusals. It's a right judgment in matters that differ. And it's something that doesn't drop out of the sky as a so-called blessing, but is achieved only through time, pain, and experience. It's a matter of steadfast growth in grace, and it's a necessity for every Christian. Prayer number two. Here Paul asks, I quote, that you may be strengthened in all power according to his glorious might, so that you may have great endurance and patience with joy. It seems, doesn't it, almost extravagant language. All power, the power of Christ's resurrection. What then? Shall we expect them to be the most brilliant, the most exceptional Christian believers in all Roman Asia? Will their fame spread swiftly among the churches? Will they be a special breed? No. Apparently, such heavenly strength will be needed simply to endure to the end. Just that. It's one of the great Colossian themes. Listen to verses 6 and 7 of chapter 2. So then, just as you received Christ Jesus as Lord, continue to live your lives in him, rooted and built up in him, strengthened in the faith as you were taught, and overflowing with thankfulness. Question. Did the troublemakers offer a distinctive power experience, a second initiation, a privileged endowment for the few? Maybe they did. It's common enough today, and could well have been so then. But you see the point, don't you? Paul is insisting that every believer needs all power, as he describes it, simply to keep going strong to the end. This glorious might is not an endowment for the few, but indispensable for all Christ's disciples. This is basic provision for the ordinary road. Thus, Paul is really asking that the future will show that this church plant, survived, that the Christians were the real thing. All knowledge and all power are necessary for recently regenerated Jack and Jill as they try to climb hill difficulty and not come tumbling down at the first real test. Prayer 3. Here Paul speaks of divine acceptance, verse 12, and divine deliverance, verse 13. I'll read this final part of the prayer once more. He requests that the young Colossian believers will, I quote, give thanks to the Father who has qualified you to share in the inheritance of his holy people in the kingdom of light. For he has rescued us, delivered us from the dominion of darkness, and brought us into the kingdom of the Son he loves, in whom we have redemption, the forgiveness of sins. My, that's terrific language and terrific reality. On verse 12, I think I'll hand over to Charlie Merle, page 55 of his CGT commentary. Quote, Merle writes, this is a pictorial phrase built in part around the Old Testament picture of the educative process by which God trained and qualified the chosen people to enter the promised land which he had assigned to them as their portion. So with Christians, who are the Israel of God, God's glorious power is able to qualify them, inherently unworthy though they are, to enter that spiritual land of promise, that realm of light. Unquote. Here we're bound to notice in chapter 2, verse 18, that some of the troublemakers went out of their way to disqualify Christian believers at Colossae. The verb might well mean, according to Mole, decide, as an umpire does, against you, or for you. For all that I knew of Professor Merle, I would not have cast him as a cricket enthusiast, but the umpire analogy is a very useful one. The verdict of the troublemakers on the new believers was out, while Paul insists that they are not out, but rightly in the fellowship of God's holy people. It's this matter of assurance again. If God is for them, who can be against them? He has accepted them into his family for the sake of his Son who died for them and rose for their justification. Paul then associates himself with the Colossians. As God had delivered him, so them. As God had brought him into the kingdom, so them. As God had redeemed him, forgiving him all his sins, so them. He may be the great and revered church leader, the apostle, and they the newest of professing Christians, but what God had done for Paul in a great deliverance, he had done for them. It may not have been so sudden or so dramatic, but it was just as authentic an experience. Nor could there ever be a deliverance greater than this once for all salvation of their souls. For myself, I can't begin to imagine words more reassuring than these. If the troublemakers unsettled the Colossians, the apostles' aim was to stabilize them and give them a firm confidence in their standing as authentic members of the Church of God. As such, they are rightly directed to be overflowing in thankfulness, chapter 2, verse 7. Here's a little summary. 1. Here in Colossians 1, Paul prays for the protection of the little churches in the Lycus Valley. Not in this case, I think, from the world's hostility, but from false brethren who would invalidate their Christian standing and experience, a second rate. 2. Here in Colossians 1, Paul prays for the progress of the little churches in the Lycus Valley, that they may advance to full maturity. Spiritual progress, as Adrian Reynolds of the Proclamation Trust has reminded us of late, is a Pauline passion. 3. In Colossians 1, Paul prays for the patience of the young believers of the Lycus Valley. It's interesting how often the writers of the New Testament strike this note. He who endures to the end will be saved. And you need to persevere so that when you've done the will of God, you will receive what he has promised. So Paul prays for the protection, the progress, and the patience of these little churches in the Lycus Valley. So a question. Do you know of any recent church plants? Perhaps they need people like Epaphras, like you, to pray for them that they may stand firm in all the will of God, mature and fully assured. Chapter 4, verse 12. That wasn't easy in the Lycus Valley, we may be sure. Pressures without, perplexities within. But God answers prayer.